Hello, everybody. Always nice to see all my friends and enemies. It's been a couple of weeks. I was off at the newly named Dala Mountain Center doing a week-long exploration on the Bardo. We had fun. At least I had fun. That's all that matters, right? So if you're new to this event, we've been doing this ever since COVID started, I think. We just get together, hang out. People send me some really interesting questions. I respond to them. And then if you have a question, it can be really about anything, at least related to this kind of business, so to speak. You can put it in the chat column. Better yet, raise your hand in the reactions bar down there. And we can always come online and talk about something live, so to speak. In terms of announcements, not a ton right now. This is a little bit of a quiet season for me, which is great. We are releasing the Bernardo Kestrup interviews, part one and two. I just sent that out to our tech team today. So the first one, first part, hour and a half, should be done, released within the next day. And then part two, not too long after that. And also this coming Monday, this is kind of cool. I'm going to be interviewing, they reached out to me, which is really fun. Sonia Rinpoche, who's an amazing guy, one of my teachers. So it's a real honor. And Dan Goleman of emotional intelligence fame. They could just call authored a book on meditation. And so I'm going to be interviewing them both, at least if we can get a Rinpoche online on Monday. So that's exciting. I'm really geared for that. The book is really, it's really a lovely romp. And so, yeah, that's it. So am I supposed to pause now, Alyssa? No, no need to pause. Okay, all right. I have to do what all my support people tell me to do. So I'm going to start with the questions that were sent in. And then again, if you have something you want to ping out, let me know and we can talk about stuff. So this is from Joe. In Tibetan Buddhism, there are many ways to purify karma. Correct. But in listening to your interviews with Delson and Armstrong, yeah, there's two of them, right? It sounded like he says the only way to eliminate or purify the karma you are born with is to experience it. And how you deal with it determines if it is purified, diminished, or adds to your karma. Okay. Did I understand him correctly? I don't remember, Joe, exactly what he said around that. Because again, we had like, 5 hours of chatting with him. But I can tell you my understanding. And then I'd have to re-listen to it to see exactly what he said. I just don't recall. Do you understand? Did I understand correctly? So I can't answer that without re-listening it. Listening to it. Do you think you can purify karma through various practices like Vajrasattva pujas, Dzogchen feast, and the like? Absolutely, positively. Absolutely. So that's the most important thing. So in this respect, and again, I can't say if that's for sure what Delson said. That's one of the great gifts of these types of meditations. You can purify these habitual patterns, because remember, that's what karma is, right? Habit patterns. It's not like some cast iron deterministic thing, you have to go through this or you're never going to experience it. And I don't think it works that way. It's just habit. So you can purify these habit patterns, these experiences, by all the methods that you talked about. You can absolutely positively do it in dream yoga. That's one main benefit of doing dream practices. You can purify karma in a dream. But the most important thing really that I'm picking out of this is how you deal with it. Here's the second part of your question here, or statement. How you deal with it determines if it is purified, diminished, or adds. That to me is the important thing, because when you're on the spiritual path, as I've come to understand it, you're opening and breaking things loose. All this stuff is going to come up. All the stuff in your unconscious mind, all the psychological habits and whatnot. And then also in your unconscious mind is all these karmic predispositions, these deeper lifetime habits, archetypal habits, they're also going to come up. That's part of the deal. That's part of the contract. And that's why if you're doing really deep practice and you're no longer just window shopping, real meditation, real spiritual practice is a blast furnace. It's no day at the beach. I mean, that's why I wrote my book, Power and Pain, which I experienced when I was doing my really long retreat. And I felt like I was in a detox center. And so the point here that I'm taking, what you're sharing here that lands with me, Joe, is how you relate to it is what is important. So in other words, you're doing your meditation, And by the way, cosmologically, this is a very brief cosmological interjection. In the Buddhist cosmological schema of world systems, if you believe in this stuff, we live in what's called Jambudvipa, which is a particular dimension of the human realm, very cosmological. And one unique feature of Jambudvipa, allegedly, is that you have the unique capacity in this dimension to purify karma very quickly. In other words, you don't have to wait for a future incarnation to burn it off. So that may be good or bad news, depending on the kind of karma that you accumulate, right? But it's apparently this is Jambudvipa is a very fortuitous place to purify a lot of karma. But the issue is when you're doing your practices and your mind is opening, remember Rinpoche, Trungpa Rinpoche meditation is not a sedative, it's a laxative. Genius. This stuff is going to come up. It has to. Because it's stuffed. It's stuffed in your subtle body. It's stuffed in your unconscious mind. It's got to come up. So then the question like you're asking here is, what are you going to do with it? How are you going to relate to it? If you push it away, repress it, reject it, you're just going to do it, a cosmic recycling process. You're going to throw it back into your unconscious mind. And there it's going to lodge ad infinitum. If you relate to it properly, you can purify it. And that proper relationship is what the path is all about. Not repressing, not indulging, just allowing, like Da Frijan said, the American sage, the fire must have its way. So this is why understanding the view that when you're doing really deep practice and things are falling apart, I mean, Pema Chodron has made a career out of this, right? But her classic book, When Things Fall Apart. When things fall apart and you have the right view, again, Trungpa Rinpoche, chaos should be regarded as extremely good news. That means the karma is ripening. You get sick, you get disease, you get all kinds of psychological upheavals. People think, man, my life was kind of together till I started this deep meditation thing. So you have to have the right view. It comes up, you hold it properly, you relate to it properly, you accelerate it with these especially tantric practices, and things start to really clean up. I mean, one personal experience decades ago when I was doing what's called Nindro, you know, I literally, no exaggeration, I did 111,000 prostrations, which is standard fare. And I expected that maybe I'd have some psychological upheavals breaking loose with all this. I was quite taken aback when, like, I had all this physical stuff happen. And it was like, wait a second. Spirituality is supposed to be spiritual. It's supposed to be about my mind. And here it was, my body was coming apart. That was a very powerful lesson, showing me that you got to include the body. So if you're doing this real deep stuff, this deep work, make sure you get your spiritual lawyer, look at the fine print, and realize you're asking for it. Okay? So great question, Joe. If you're on it and want to say more about it, more than welcome. Okay. All right. Here's one from Katie. Have I understood correctly that one who recognizes, realizes clear light and the death process is liberated from the impulsive rebirth? So there's two parts to this question. Yes or no, Katie, it depends on the degree of recognition. If the degree is that the recognition is complete and we have what's called the mother and child reunion, the mother and child luminosities recognizing each other, yes, then that's liberation in one life. They call it that. And then you're free from any impulse of rebirth. And if you want to recycle, take rebirth, you do so voluntarily. So everything here depends on the degree of the recognition. If it's just a glimpse, no, it's not strong enough. There's not enough stability. If the stability is really there, you just hit a grand slam, you're good. That's a bit rare, but it's not unheard of. That's why you want to cultivate as much as you can in this life. The development, the maturation of what's called the child luminosity. Exactly what we talked about 2 weeks ago during the Gala Mountain Center program. Part two of the question, are the persons who recognize clear light in the deep sleep or tantric practices then already liberated? No, for exactly the same reason. I should say yes and no, for exactly the same reason. Because if they recognize clear light, like if they have 24/7 awareness, they recognize this black clear light all the way through the night, then yes, they're liberated. They're already awakened for sure. But if they have like a fleeting glimpse and there's a little recognition and it fades, a little recognition and it's fade, no, the stability isn't there. And so that's why. Okay. Oh yeah, this ties into your next part. Have I understood correctly that the liberation from impulsive rebirth doesn't mean automatically Buddhahood? Correct. Because there are many bodhisattva levels before. Yeah, there's at least 10 of them, depending on the system, the 10 bhumis, the 10 grounds. So yes, that's correct. Liberation from impulsive rebirth doesn't automatically mean Buddhahood. Because for one thing, you know, bodhisattva levels and then all the levels of enlightenment. You know, I mean, enlightenment is this multivalent term that has degrees. Rarely, I mean, virtually never, does someone just suddenly pop and they achieve a complete 100% irreversible, non-retrogressive awakening. Just doesn't work that way generally. Why? Because again, there's no stability. Habit patterns haven't been purified. And so therefore the stability is everything here. So in this case, if you're referring to the bodhisattva levels, those are the 10 bhumis, yeah, you still have, you know, 10 major levels to achieve before you achieve. This is interesting to say achieving. This is a little tricky term because it means just parenthetically that somehow we have to achieve, gain something that's other. And that's why this notion of achievement is actually quite tricky. It's more the notion of recognition that you're talking about. You're not actually attaining levels, you're discovering them. Okay, again from part three from Katie, do the kleshas, emotional upheavals, conflicting emotions, that's what that term means in Sanskrit. Do the kleshas manifest as knots at the subtle body? Yeah, you betcha. Absolutely. I mean, if you were to take, I often use this analogy, take an X-ray, fMRI, CAT scan of a confused sentient being like me, you would find a subtle body system full of knots and twists and crinkles and all kinds of things. So yes, indeed, the subtle body has, there's a subtle body correlate to these emotional upheaval states, the kleshas. And so therefore you can use your body to work with your mind. You can use your mind to work with your body. That's the great gift of the tantric approach, this bi-directional thing altogether. My riff is why not use both, right? Okay, here's another one from Joe. This is a quick one. Do you need a lot less sleep if you do several hours of meditation a day? Does meditation serve as a substitute for sleep and meet the needs for a physical body for sleep? It depends again. So if you have really deep meditation and you can rest in high formless jhana states, deep delta, yeah. In fact, you don't need to sleep at all. Now that doesn't mean you stay up all night playing video games, right? That means the mind just goes from gross to subtle to very subtle, and you maintain a 24/7 level of awareness. And the study, there's a lot of studies on this. Anecdotally, it's the same as well. People who do just a ton of meditation absolutely positively sleep less and less and less, because on one level, there's, you know, it's metaphorical and it's literal that if they're distracted less, analog to biological sleep, you don't need to physically sleep as much. And so again, in the mind of an awakened one, they literally do not sleep, literally, not metaphorically. And I've asked a ton of meditation masters about this, and every single one of them says absolutely positively. It may seem incredulous, unbelievable, but it's absolutely positively the case. And they can put some of these people in the lab, sleep labs, and they can maintain, I mean, they maintain awareness. It's pretty interesting stuff. So to see the meditation serve as a substitute for sleep, if it's deep enough, it can, absolutely, absolutely. TM started studying this like 40, 50 years ago, even. The whole TM people, I'm pretty sure way back when, I've got it somewhere in my old dusty library, reading some data about TM. In fact, I remember when I did my TM instruction, they riffed on this. I can't remember exactly, don't quote me on this. If you do your 20 minutes of TM, it has the equivalent of a couple hours of sleep. I can't guarantee that that's exactly what they said, but it was definitely something like that. So that's for sure. Okay, from Jason. And this one, if Jason's here, this would be really great if he came on, because the question's a little opaque to me and I need some clarification. Why do reality checks if the assumption is that you are dreaming? Well, what I need to know, Jason, is what dream are you referring to? Are you referring to the double delusion example dream, the nighttime dream? Or are you referring about to the primary real dream, this? And so it really depends on what type of dream you're referring to, right? Yeah, and so the reason, just to paraphrase, the reason we do these reality checks is that we are under the assumption, not that we're dreaming, but that we're awake. And that's why we do state checks, reality checks in the nocturnal arena to state checks to test the veracity of what state of consciousness we're in. But the kicker is here in this dimension, the very criteria that we use to determine that we're asleep in the nocturnal dream are the very criteria that are used to determine that you're still asleep in the primary dream. And that's where the things get really interesting. So dream science work, the same narrative applies to both types of dream, but the relationship to those dream signs is radically different, right? So Jason, everything depends on what type of dream are you talking about. So if you're here and want to come on, that would be great. Here's one from Tim. Okay, in one of your meditation videos, if you asked the members the question, where does the anger come from when it arises? A few members answered the question, and you said their responses were close to the right answer, but not quite. My answer to the question would be that the anger arises and manifests from nothing, and that is ultimately the same place where it dissolves. Is this correct? If not, I'm wondering if you can tell me the right answer or point me in the direction where I can find it. Okay, Tim. So it doesn't arise from nothing. It arises from no thingness. That's a big difference. So this question can be addressed both in a relative and absolute way. From an absolute perspective, everything arises from Rigpa, Dharma Dhatu, Dharmakaya, Dharma Ta, whatever term you want to use, from the nature of mind and reality. Everything comes from that. From a relative perspective, then this can come, this is somewhat connected to the other question about the kleshas, this can come from the basis of the relative expression of samsaric reality, which is the eighth consciousness. And then you can also say it comes from the knots in your subtle body. So once you enter the realm of the relative, you can answer this question in a number of different ways, depending on the school that you are referring to, right? So it definitely doesn't arise from nothing. In an absolute sense, it arises from no thingness, the emptiness, luminosity of Rigpa, the nature of mind. So that's one that's a little bit more absolute. The relative answer, there are many, many different answers to where the anger comes from. And then you have to bring in the psychological agendas as well. Understanding also, oops, wait a second, that just disappeared. Hold on. My screen just did something weird. Oh, you heard us. Then they have the whole relative perspective thing, right? But to me, it sounds like you're asking more where it comes from on an absolute level. It comes from Rigpa. If you want to understand this, both relative and absolute, probably the Yogacara tradition, the work of Karl Brunholzl, he has written a ton on this. So anything, Tim, that deals with a Yogacara, you've heard me use that term a lot, the eight consciousnesses, and then the professed ninth mind, ninth consciousness, that answers this question to your total satisfaction. Okay, from Glenn, in your recent conversation with Delson, oh, cool, people are listening to that. I really like this guy. I'm going to bring him back, and we're going to continue our romp through the 12 Madonnas dependent origination, because that's kind of his big thing, and he is really on that one. Okay, in my conversation with Delson, he indicated that awareness / Rigpa, correct, remains through deep sleep. He didn't use the word Rigpa, because that's not a Theravadan approach. I interjected that. But anyway, he indicated that awareness remains through deep sleep. And if memory serves me, that he doesn't really dream anymore. Are these indicators for enlightenment? Again, I'll just stop there for a second. Depends on what you mean by enlightenment, right? So we have this catch-all phrase, enlightenment, for a ton of granularity. So what type of enlightenment are you talking about? Hamid Ali, who's written a number of curious, interesting books, he shares a story about when people ask him, something about his enlightenment, can you talk to us about your enlightenment experience? His common response is, which one? So it depends. Are these indicators for enlightenment? It depends. depends on which stage. Are you talking about arhathood? Are you talking about Buddhahood? Are you talking about one of the Bodhisattva levels? Are you talking about one of the stages of a Mahamudra? This isn't just arm sharing. This is actually a granularity that we can bring to our understanding of what is usually just a catch-all term, enlightenment. Well, like, what is that exactly, right? Used to be a magazine by that title by Andrew Cohen called What is Enlightenment? It's not an easy answer, not an easy thing to address. My understanding, back to Glenn, my understanding is that enlightenment can be defined by being locked into Rigpa. I guess you could use that term without interruption. I guess that's A. Is that how you might define enlightenment? Aye, Glenn. You know, here's the thing about enlightenment. When you come to these sorts of things, Glenn, I kind of get to the Prasangika Majjhimaka approach, the via the non-affirming negation, that basically enlightenment is best defined by what it is not. Because the minute you assert it, you can deconstruct it. And so therefore, anything you can, like Korzybski, the semanticist, even said this. And again, this is not sophistry. This is really the real deal. Whatever you say it is, it isn't. And so this is precisely why the Prasangika Majjhimaka people, Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti and all these Buddhapala and all these others came along to basically say, you can't say anything about it. You can intimate it, you can point at it, you can make some suggestions, but really the best way to discover what enlightenment is in fact just that. Just remove the via negativa, the apophatic way, just remove, cut, 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 and then you'll know. How you define it? I mean, locked into Rigpa without interruption is one good way. If you brought that assertion to Nagarjuna, he would shred it. You could say it's the stabilized recognition, realization of luminosity and emptiness. If you brought that to Nagarjuna, he would shred it. So this whole notion of what enlightenment is, again, geez, not so easy to say. It's one way, I think you could say provisionally, conventionally, if you put everything in quotation marks, it's a state of uninterrupted non-dual awareness / Rigpa. Yes, I think you can say that, okay? Now, what does that mean? Delson is enlightened? Who knows? I'm not gonna go there. I have no idea. I really like the guy. He's a beautiful human being. I find him very humble, very genuine. And I have to say, I'm usually super skeptical. When I first heard about him, like, I don't know when, a couple of years ago, I was like, oh, go, here we go. Another guy, another Westerner who's attained enlightenment, right? I've seen so many of these and then they go crashing and burning. It's like, give me a break. But Delson, I was really attracted to what I heard about him. I saw some of his clips. I have friends who are friends of his. I said, this is a cool guy. And so can I say he's enlightened? I have no idea. But he has a wonderful heart, a wonderful mind. Hey, that's good enough for me, right? I'll take that. Okay, so if anybody has I'm going to scroll through to see if I miss anything. If anybody has a live question or something in the chat, I can pull that up real quick. We can run with something or not.
I'll get you unmuted here, Deborah.
In the meantime, okay. See if I missed anything. Hey, Deborah.
Hi, Andrew. Wonderful to be with you and see you.
Hi.
Hi. I have kind of a little bit of context I want to share, which has two questions in it. So I became a student of Adi Da in 1986.
Oh my God.
And then was involved with Samuel Bonder's work for many years. Right. And through learning about you through the integral world.
Oh, nice.
Last year I read Preparing to Die and have then been opened into so many streams of wisdom through you. And I've taken many virtual courses with you, not yet one in person, but I look forward to that.
Thanks.
And one of the tributaries has led me to Dan Brown's work through Dustin DiPerna.
Yeah, you know, he passed recently.
I do, right. And I am curious of your thoughts about Dan's work or his rendition or translation or compilation of what he's put together.
Okay.
And, but the question for me personally is about breath and breathing, because I tend to be a kind of anxious, perfectionistic, compulsive person. And with instruction about breathing, I tend to get I guess what Dan calls tangled up in breath, like just right. The more I watch it, the less I breathe and the right. more complicated right. I become.
Right.
And yet in doing that practice, you know, there's no substituting some other object, at least that I know yet. So I'm just wondering, with the practice of shamatha, how important is it to use the breath, this changing voluntary, involuntary process, which for me is very problematic?
So just say a little bit more about why it is problematic. Outside of what you just said, is it just you kind of implode around it? Or tell me a little bit more about it.
Yeah, I start thinking very much rather than directly perceiving the breath.
Yeah.
And my chest gets constricted and I breathe less and I try to breathe in a certain, it's just like.
Yeah, I get it. Okay. Well, a couple of things. First of all, I'll kind of backpedal. Just one or two words about Adida, Da Frijan, Da Lovananda. I mean, how many different names did this guy have? He had a big impact on me way back when, actually about the same time he had a big impact on Ken Wilber. I have a whole shelf all devoted to his work. And this guy was out there, right? I mean, he was radical. He was brilliant. He was iconoclastic. He was nuts in the crazy wisdom lineage. And I learned a ton from him. So Dan Brown, he's amazing. I have a lot of respect. Also, Dustin. Dustin is a really, really good dear friend. If you go onto my Edge of Mind podcast or nightclub, you know, I have an interview with Dustin.
Yeah, I've heard it.
Yeah, we're in a study group together, so I hang with him quite a bit. But Dan Brown is really amazing. Tremendous scholar, tremendous intellect, really big in the world of Mahamudra, did some amazing translations. He's created this very skillful, you know more about than I do, this really skillful kind of cultural translation, mostly of the Mahamudra tradition, that I think is really quite special. And the fact that someone like Dustin is his Dharma heir now and is taking the mantle says a lot, because Dustin is equally that way. He's also an amazing individual with a heart of gold, super smart, and just the real deal. So I have no reservations, hesitations to endorse Dan Brown or Dustin DePerna. These guys are way up there in my world. So good for you. You're in good company. Now the breath thing is a really interesting one, right? It's such a big deal, as you probably know, that even the word spirit is derived from a root that means breath. So breath work is huge. Specifically in terms of how to work with it, what you're sharing is not that unusual. And there's several ways to do this within the context of shamatha proper. And then there's also some kind of supplemental types of things you might explore to help perhaps dislodge this temporary hiccup in relationship to your breath work. I mean, my teacher, Krump Rinpoche, talked about like a 25% awareness on the breath, which I thought was quite good. Because if one becomes too one-pointed, then you can get this kind of implosive characteristic, right? So it was very interesting. We tend to point out shamatha, vipassana, but they're never really separate. You can't separate them. We temporarily centrifuge them out for heuristic purposes, for teaching purposes, but they're inextricably connected. And so when Rinpoche taught shamatha, he taught it mixed with vipassana. And that's why he was actually quite cautious about becoming too one-pointed. He wasn't interested in the jhana states at all, as most Mahamudra Dzogchen people are. They could care less about those things, because there is a potential if you become one-pointed in a kind of a locked-in way, then that can become a little bit too tight. So the 25% then therefore means 75% is environmental awareness. And so if you just shift that allegiance right there, that might soften things for you. But the whole point isn't to just like lock down on the breathing, because then if you do, I think what happens is you fall into this too tight syndrome, which is what I'm feeling from you. So the balancing point, right? Not too tight, not too loose. This is what we do. We ping off extremes. And so if you're in that particular level, it's totally completely workable. The other thing is, in addition to the 25-75%, is this is very much a somatic felt exercise with breath. You know, it's really You're not thinking about it. You're not visualizing it. You're just simply feeling the natural movement of your breathing. And so I think along those lines, that in itself could be very helpful. Also, if you haven't read it, I found Charlie Morley's recent book. I interviewed him. In fact, if you look at my second interview with Charlie, you'll find this a nightclub for sure. I'm not sure if it's on Edge of Mind. But Charlie's a wonderful guy. The second interview I did with him not that long ago was on his most recently released book. And he has some really nice things in there about breath work. This way to work with just softening our relationship to it, you know, doing kind of preparatory breath work before you actually even start meditation. I found it actually quite skillful. I can't remember the title of the book off the top of my head, but if you look at, if you listen to the interview on Nightclub, you'll get it. And so I think if you do that, and then also, do you do yoga or any kind of body work? Do you do anything like that? Hatha yoga or Ashtanga or Vinyasa, or do you do any kind of yoga?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And so what happens when you're involved with your yoga, with your asanas and the breathing then? Breathing's probably not a problem, right?
Yeah, it's natural. It opens because exactly. I'm not tightly focusing on it, just like you said.
Exactly. And it's because your body is inviting, almost forcing more of an environmental awareness. See? And so, you know, this is why it's helpful to understand the view of shamatha altogether. It doesn't matter if you're doing it with yoga. It doesn't matter if you're doing it with, I shouldn't say that. I have to say that with in quotations. The essence of the shamatha vector, so to speak, is pacification, tranquility. You're just trying to settle the mind. And so if you do that, then you realize that yoga can do it. Walking meditation can do it. And I might invite some more kind of movement-based practices, walking meditation, yoga, tai chi. I don't know if you do lujong, those sorts of practices. They will help you relate to your breath in a perhaps a more gentle way. The other thing you can do that you can try just for kicks, and again, do this to see if it works, become your own meditation instructor. You can take a break when you feel like you're getting all kind of wound up, so to speak. And you can do a ninefold breath purification thing. You know, what you do is you put your hands, your thumb at the base of your ring finger, close it over your fist, take a really deep breath, put it on your knees, hold the deep breath for, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 seconds. And then you do a very powerful exhalation. You start slow, and then at the end, quite forceful, and you splay the fingers out. And there's a sense of just blowing out all the cylinders, all the pores, exhaling through every pore in your body. And you do this slowly, so there's no hyperventilation thing, 9 times. And then notice when you're at the end of that ninth repetition, which can take 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, notice how your breath and mind really start to settle. And so as an antidote on the spot, so that you can work with this and apply a remedy, you could also explore something like that. But I think within that view, the 25-75%, connecting into the feeling you get when you're doing your yoga, how that's not a problem with your breath work, then you might be able to invite that type of panoramic awareness / vipassana ingredient in concert with your shamatha, so that you don't become excessively one-pointed. Because all these practices have their near enemies, and definitely one near enemy of shamatha is this kind of radical one-pointedness, which is somewhat ironic because then, like you're saying, it backfires. You're just too tight. Okay. Yeah. Welcome. Cool.
Was the book called Wake Up to Sleep?
I think that's it. Yeah. Okay. Thanks for pulling that up. Yeah. Check it out. Charlie's got some cool things to say about breathing. Or the other one is Wim Hof, right? Right. Read some of his stuff. He does some very interesting work with breath. Some of his jingles are X-rated, so I won't yell them out over the forum here. But anyway, it's all workable. Okay. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, Andrew. It's good to see you again.
To see you, bro. What's up?
Yeah. So I had another dream experience. I don't really have a question, but I guess I do in a way. I just wanted to tell you about it.
And yeah, fire.
What you fire think? Away. Perfect. So maybe about a month ago, I finally finished your course on the Pure Lands.
Oh,
Oh my goodness, it was great. I never, you know, had been exposed to anything like that.
Oh, nice. Cool.
So my grandmother passed away. She's the first person I ever known to actually have passed away. So it kind of like shook me up. So I woke up from a dream one night and she was in the dream and I was like really disturbed. You know, really emotional, more emotional than I kind of have ever been. So I was like, okay, I want to see if I can have a lucid dream. I heard about people asking for a teaching in a dream. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, maybe I can ask for a teaching to kind of learn how to deal with this, or, you know, it kind of made death more real to me now. Yeah. Versus, you know, something you just hear about on TV or.
Right. That's a good thing, actually.
So I was like, oh, who am I going to ask? You know, I've had previous experiences where I've called like on Padmasambhava. I was like, oh, well, I heard, you know, Amitabha is the Buddha of compassion. I was like, I should probably ask someone who's compassionate. So I said, okay.
They're all compassionate.
Cool. So typically I make a dream plan like, you know, farther in advance. This one was really on the fly.
Yeah, nice.
Okay, you know, I'm gonna have a lucid dream. I'll ask Amitabha for a lesson. So cool. I, you know, do my wake back to bed, go to sleep, get lucid. And then when I get there, I start, you know, like yelling his name. Nothing really happens. I said, oh, the mantra. I remember, use the mantra.
Nice.
So I used the mantra. There was like a cloud. It kind of shimmered a little bit. And then from off in the distance coming towards me were three figures. Oh. So there was one in the middle who, you know, I'm assuming is Amitabha. There was one on his right, my left, and it actually looked like Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche. Cool. He was carrying a yellow notepad and a calculator. And then on the other side was another figure I could not, you know, just someone, yeah. But I don't know who.
Yeah.
So the one on his left walks kind of behind me. Then once it disappears, walks behind me, I can't see it anymore. So I'm just seeing, you know, Tenzin and Amitabha, and the first thing he says to me, he's like, you need guidance from a woman. I said, thank you.
Cool.
And I kind of got this feeling that maybe the way that I asked for him to come was not appropriate, but he did not say anything. So I just didn't say anything either. And I was going to ask for a lesson for me, but in the moment I said, you know, I don't want to do that. Now that I'm here, I actually, and previous to that, before I manifested him, I manifested my grandmother so I could speak to her a little bit.
Cool.
So I said, you know, my grandmother passed away. It would really mean a lot to me if you could find her and look after her and take care of her.
Oh, wow.
And so him and Tenzin are speaking to each other. I can't understand the language. And I give them her name. They repeat her name many, many times. And then they say like Da Ki. They keep saying her name, Da Ki, her name, Da Ki. And I kind of peek over on the paper to see what's on the paper. There's a number written there. I'm like, okay, you know, and they're talking. I didn't want to interrupt, but I had to interrupt. I'm like, hey, I've been in the dream quite a while now. I'm going to wake up soon, you know, so I'm running low on time. He's like, okay. He's like, okay, no problem. He's like, I'm going to give you a sign. I was like, oh, you know, I didn't even think about the sign. I was just going to ask you and then be done with it. He said, when the light touches the sky, you'll know it's done. I said, okay, thank you. So I was like, okay, well, it's time for me to go. Normally in my dreams, I know when I'm going to wake up because I can kind of feel my body in the bed too.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm like, okay, well, it's going to happen any moment now. So then I wake up and between my curtains, it's like the sun is just coming into the sky.
That's awesome.
And so a few, you know, before all of this happened, I could feel her around.
Yeah.
It's interesting because other people would come into my home and they would kind of get spooked out a little bit. And multiple people brought it to my attention. They're like, I don't know what you're doing in here. They're like, is there something in here living with you? No, I think you're fine. You know, I didn't want to bring it up. I said, you're fine. And so, but now I don't feel hurt anymore and I feel a lot more calm. So that was my experience. Awesome, and I just wanted to see, you know.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for sharing it. I love these kinds of dream sharing things. This is just rocks. I mean, high five for you, my friend. I mean, super, super cool. The fact, I mean, there's so much to say. The fact that people were noticing and you felt as well that there was this presence of her around you, then there was, because she was most certainly attracted to your mind space and taking refuge in your good hearted mind, and you were helping her. And so that's a really wonderful thing. And the fact that at a certain point you didn't feel her suggests to me that then either through Amitabha, Tenzin Wangyal, or whoever that other person was, they could have very well done a type of POA on your behalf. It's called the Iron Hook of Compassion. I mean, I can't say for sure, right? But this is a kind of a standard esoteric, don't go hand in hand, but you get the idea, a standard kind of tantric transference of consciousness thing that really advanced practitioners, Buddhas and the like, have the capacity to do. And for you then to have the wherewithal in the dream to set the intention to ask this higher agency, whatever it was, to actually look out and do something for her, that's actually an invitation to do the Iron Hook of Compassion. And my guess is the fact that you felt her and then you didn't feel her means that they were somehow able to do that, find her consciousness, hook it, and then who knows where they took her. Maybe they took her just to Kavadi, I don't know. Mm-hmm. So I'm sharing this partly from my own experience. So I had a somewhat similar thing when my mom died. Some decades ago, I had a really very powerful connection to her. And after she passed, I actually invited her into my practice space. I would call her when I was doing my practices. I would invite her into my space and I would say, you know, certain things, if there's any way I can help you by just being here with you, please be with me. And so I felt her presence a lot. And then I had a really strong connection to Trungpa Rinpoche at that time. And the day that she passed, I was able to reach out to him through his receptionist secretary, who I know really well. And then I gave a little teacher's gift and I said, you know, can you ask Rinpoche to do this POA for my mom? And I didn't hear anything back. Like 2, 3, 4 days later, I did my morning practice and someone like you was like, I no longer felt her. It was like, well, geez, that's interesting. I'm not feeling Maria, that was her name. I'm not feeling mom anymore. And then my niece, completely, I didn't mention anything to her. My niece said something very similar that day. I think it was actually the day of the funeral. She said, you know, it's really interesting. I'm not feeling Maria here anymore. And then later that afternoon, I got an email confirmation from Trungpa Rinpoche's secretary receptionist that was the day that he actually did POA for her. Mm-hmm. And so what you're sharing sounds very similar to that experience I had with my mom. And so I'm just going to leave it at that because I don't want to water down with my silly blathering the beauty of what you shared. It's a fantastic dream. And I just want to give you a high five hug, man. I mean, just super cool. Yeah, really. Thanks for sharing. It's a wonderful thing.
Thank you. Can I ask just another smaller question?
Yeah, sure. Fire away.
So another practice that I have done, and I actually did it before my grandmother passed, even after her passing, and it is not from Buddhism, at least I don't think so, but there's an African spirituality called Ifa, and it's heavy into ancestor veneration. And I know, like, I'm asking about two different things, but I'm not sure if there are such types of practices in Buddhism, but I was wondering, like, when people pray to their ancestors or leave offerings for their ancestors, I have trouble understanding kind of what is going on, considering things like reincarnation, like where are those offerings going to? if the person is, you know, I'm like, so what's exactly going on?
That's a really difficult question to answer because it's different for the cultures, right? I can't speak to this particular African tradition and what they're doing, but this whole notion is called filial piety. This is very common in Asian countries, period. I'm sure in many indigenous cultures. So I can't speak with any authority about what they're actually doing. I can only tell you from my side, my understanding, that what takes place anytime there's this type of ancestral, you know, sometimes worship is used in the Buddhist tradition. They don't really use that type of terminology. But there is this recognition of connectivity to karmic mind streams. You know, they have their own languaging for this thing. Mm-hmm. So within a Buddhist framework, when you're making these offerings and whatnot, what's actually being offered is a particular quality of mind. The material offerings, they're inconsequential. The material offerings are just a skid ramp for the mind and heart that's cultivated by making that offering. And then in a universe that's not made of matter, but a universe that's made of heart, mind, spirit, then these types of dedications of merit and whatnot can actually benefit for sure. So I'm cautious to dip into these toes because I'm not a cultural anthropologist. I can't speak at all to what other cultures do when they engage in these notions of ancestor worship and filial piety. But in the Buddhist tradition, there is some connection, at least in the relationship that I just mentioned. Okay bud? Yeah, thank nice to see you. So much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Take care. Hi, Anita. Fire away if you have a question. Oh yeah, Queen Elizabeth passed away. That's right.
Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Hello?
Hi.
So I have a question. I don't know if this is the place, but I've been in nightclubs for a long time, but I'm not, many times I don't have time to have all the things nightclub offers me. Okay. So, but lately I've been trying to get into the interviews and it doesn't let me in. I mean, I got into the Charlie's, wonderful. The interview about the trauma and the breathing. I mean, there's not a second that you have to lose in that interview. But then the Del Sun says not ready yet or something like that.
Maybe so you're having some technical problems.
Many interviews I just can't get.
Well, you know, that's really important for me to hear because then I just, that all can be fixed. I just need to know about it. So you can send, there should be a place, you can send it, andrew@andrewholacek.com. You can just send me an email. I'll forward it to my tech people and they'll get on it right away because this is the kind of stuff we need to know about. I mean, if there's something that's not functioning, we need to know about it. And because the website's getting bigger, there's more plugins, sometimes things collapse that way. And so thank you for bringing it to our attention. So send me an email or.
Okay. If you can put me the email there, because there's so much nightclub can offer me. And when I have the time, I say, okay, I'm going to listen to something and I just can't get there. I don't know if it is my fault.
Yeah,
I have a full membership.
Yeah, we can help you with that for sure. That's why I have my tech people. But we need
Thank
to know.
Thank you so much. And I have another comment. Somebody gave me this watch that says how I am dreaming.
Oh yeah, like, yeah, Feedback. Exactly. Yeah, probably. Yeah.
And it's very strange because often I wake up like at 4 in the morning. I don't move and I meditate without moving. I just can't do the breathing thing. It's the same problem as they were. I can do, I just focus in the heart and I meditate and it's really easy to get very, very calm. Nice. Then in the morning, I read what this software says and the time I know I'm awake, I'm meditating, it says deep sleep.
Yeah, you're probably in Delta. So that's a little bit tied to the question earlier about whether you're meditating or and getting the rest that you need. So your comment ties into the earlier question. So you're probably in deep meditation and you're in a delta phase. And so you're aware. You're just aware in delta wavelength sleep. So that's a really beautiful thing. So again, I can't say for 100% sure, but that would connect to that possibility. The other thing is, as Dr. Ed, our sleep doctor, often tells us, all these gadgets they're helpful, but they're not always 100% accurate. So I can't speak to the accuracy of what you're actually saying, but I think perhaps the message would be connected to the earlier question about if you do deep meditation, is it the equivalent of sleeping? It could possibly, what you're sharing is just a further affirmation that yes. Okay.
Well, it occurred to me now that you were talking about sleeping and meditating, that yeah. I just thought that this watch doesn't work, but now it just says that I am in deep sleep. So I don't worry that I'm not sleeping enough because...
Yeah, I mean, again, if you're rested during the day and you're not dozing off, and you're not, then you're getting the rest that you need, right? So chances are quite good that you're just in a really slow wave pattern when you're
engaged. I didn't know I could get into Delta. I don't think I'm so skilled, but maybe.
You never know. You never know. Yeah, you never know. Give yourself more credit. Give yourself more credit. You may be dropping into it and don't even know it. So that's pretty cool.
Thank you.
Welcome. Okay, so there's something here from, yeah, Queen Elizabeth passed today. Sad. I liked her. I thought she was really cool. So we have to beam thoughts of goodness and kindness to the whole royal family and everybody suffering from that loss. She was pretty cool. So when Queen Elizabeth passed, I'm reminded that you have said we can practice and in so doing help those who have passed. Can you talk more about how to do this practice? Sure, I can. I talk about it, Candy, just briefly. I talk about it a ton in my book, Preparing to Die. Also, Tulku Tundra Rinpoche talks about this a ton in his book, Peaceful Death, Joyful Rebirth. So this is a really big topic. There's so many different ways you can help kind of this bardo midwifery thing. But the most important thing, really the simplest thing, there's all kinds of esoteric rituals that I write about in the book, what's called a burnt offering, a sur offering, all these practices you can do, and they're all wonderful, but they can get a little cultural and they can get a little bit, possibly complex. But the most important thing you can do really is that every time you think of the person who has transitioned, you think of them with love. Every time you do anything of any value, a meditation practice or a donation, any worthy cause, you do a dedication of merit in their name. That is the simplest and most powerful thing you can do. And all the Tibetans and other wisdom traditions will tell you, again, you know, because the world is not made out of matter, the world is made of mind. Listen to the interview with Bernardo that I'm about to release. We have a lot more power than we can think. You can do Tonglin for them, the practice of sending and taking. You can do essential poa for them. There's just so much. But to keep it really simple, every time you think of them, you can think of them with openness and kindness and love. Every time you do anything of any value benefit, sometimes you can do it overtly. That's called the savings of life practice. We used to do it at the Abbey all the time, where people would go down to the wharf and buy all these crabs that were set for the market and take them back out to the ocean and let them go, dedicating that for the benefit of beings. So maybe that in conjunction with the references of Preparing to Die book, and then Tulku Tundra talks about it a ton, the Pure Land practices, the Poa practices, there's so much you can do. But just to keep it simple, that might be enough. Okay, what do we got here? Yeah, there we go. Anybody else before we click off? We're close to the hour mark, which is usually when we try to click off, but any other last offerings or questions or jokes? Otherwise, this week is a little bit light. Next week is really full. We've got meditation group. We've got a new night for our Dr. Ed sleep doctor. I think it's next Tuesday because we're shifting from Wednesday to Tuesday night. Then we have the book study group. Then we've got dream sharing. And then we're going to be releasing, I think, the Bernardo Castro interview. So lots coming up. And speaking of the Pure Lands, I actually did forget. We don't have it listed yet, but I just sent the text off. Aaron, you might be interested in this, for Deep Dive Pure Lands weekend number 2 in October. I think it's like the second or third weekend. I don't know exactly, but it's going to be a 3-day deep dive, part 2 of the Pure Land thing. I did forget about that, but that's not posted yet. So any last last words before we check out for today, or are we good for now? We're right about the hour mark, which is cool. Nothing else coming in. So nice to see everybody. We do this, you know, dedication of merit. If it means anything to you, anything that we've done of any value, we beam out to all sentient beings, and maybe particularly to Queen Elizabeth and all the people that are adversely affected by that transition. But otherwise, if you want, you can turn on your camera, unmute yourself, and we can do this totally sweet, geeky thing. This little group hug in cyberspace, which is kind of cool.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Next time.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
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 My favorite part.
Everybody.
Bye.
I love it. Take care, everybody. See you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
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 Bye. Thank you. I was having trouble with getting the interviews too.
Oh, who said that?
Sadaka.
Okay.
Hey, Julia Gibbs.
What is going on there?